Welcome to Inside Analog Photography Radio Program. I'm your host, Scott Shepard, and of course, the Inside Analog Photography Radio Program is all about traditional process photography. We talk about instant photography. We talk about black and white. We talk about color film. We talk about dry plate, wet plate, you name it, alternate printing processes, everything going on in analog photography. And of course, the Inside Analog Photography Radio Program is brought to you by Fujifilm over at www.fujifilmusa.com/professional. They have beautiful C41 color neg, black and white, color chrome, and of course, instant. Instant film rocks. These guys have so much great things going on right now with instant film. Of course, they have the pack film in 3.25 by 4.25 and 4.5. Color, black and white, high-speed black and white. But you know what's even cooler? They have the Instex cameras and film. The Instex Wide is in the country, available everywhere. And of course, right now, brand new, the Instex Mini is now in the U.S. They have cameras. They have film. This Instex Mini is 2.5 by 3.5. It's the size of a business card. This is really fun stuff. You got to check it out. www.fujifilmusa.com/professional, making life more colorful. Our friends at Richard Photo Lab, the place to send all your film to get developed, proofs, you name it. They got a great workflow going. www.richardphotolab.com. DR5 for the most unbelievable proprietary process to turn your black and white film into positives, into chrome. You won't believe until you get your film back as a piece of chrome will blow your mind. The dynamic range, the latitude, it's just unbelievable stuff. Definitely check it out. www.dr5.com. Iger Studios, Lenny Iger, the place to have high-resolution scans done. You know, a lot of people now are shooting analog. They're using a high-resolution scan. They're making digital negatives on an inkjet. Or maybe they're going straight to an inkjet output, but they're making digital negatives and they're printing contact prints. They're doing all the stuff you need to get a high-resolution scan. They're using an Aztec Premier, 8,000 PPI, adjustable aperture. They can give you scans that are basically grain-free. They can adjust it for every kind of film out there. This is crazy stuff going on with Lenny Iger and the guys at Iger Studios. Check them out, igerstudios.com. And, of course, Upstrap at upstrap-pro.com. The camera strap that will not slide off your shoulder. Our media partners, www.apug.org, the Analog Photography User Group. The place on the web for all things analog process. This is a great place to learn, to share information, to get tips and tricks. The community for analog photography, www.apug.org. And of course, our photographic philanthropy partner, George Eastman House International Museum of Photography and Film, www.geh.org. The place to go to find out about the history of traditional analog photography. These people are keeping this alive. They have over 7,000 cameras in their museum of everything that's ever been made, including the Hasselblads that were shot on the moon. You name it. They have the collection. This is a great way to help support. You can be a member of George Eastman House organization. They have a lot of great things going on, but this is something you can do to help give back to photography, to help keep traditional analog photography alive for generations to come. Definitely check them out, www.geh.org. Today on Inside Analog Photo, we're going to have with us Stephen Schaub, the leader of the Fidgetal Revolution. Stephen is a hybrid artist, does a lot of great work, beautiful photography, graduate of RIT, and an all-around cool guy. And of course, Stephen's been with us before, and of course, will be with us here in the future, talking about all things analog photography, hybrid workflows, and just commentating on what's going on in the industry. Stephen, how you doing today, buddy?
Pretty good. How are you doing?
Good. Thanks for joining us here on Inside Analog Photo. Always great to have you on the program. How are things over at Indian Hill Image Works?
Well, it's sunny today. That's a good thing for Vermont. And things are going good. We've been sort of growing and expanding and adding new printers and software solutions. So things are sort of on a nice uptick right now.
That is great. And that's one thing I want to talk about. It has a combination of some stuff that you chatted about on one of your programs, the Fidgetal Revolution, maybe a week or two ago. And then some of the announcements lately here in the industry when it comes to digital acquisition, digital cameras, this gear, that gear. I think I want to chat today about GAS. Gear acquisition syndrome, and where do you need to draw the line on what you have? I think people are in this mix now of, even if they're shooting film and they're doing analog capture, they get tied up into this digital blender and into this deal where they need to keep buying and buying. Is it just the fact of people like to get new stuff? Is it they think they need better stuff? And where do you need to draw the line, really, when it comes to, like, you know something? I have a nice camera. It's going to be as good as the film I'm sticking through it. And my output, no matter what I'm doing, is going to be here. I mean, I guess the point is, where do you draw the line on quality of gear?
Well, I think it's a great topic, and I think that when I'm working with students or talking about this on the Digital Revolution, I always tell people that as photographers, we're concerned with making prints. And I think that in the digital age, a lot of people have sort of forgotten about that because they take images, they post them on the internet, never actually, in some cases, ever make prints from it. But as a working photographer, for me, I think about the print first, and I sort of work backwards. And that way, I can think about, well, how big can my printer print? How much resolution do I need to print on that type of printer? What kind of papers am I going to run, and what kind of specific resolutions might one paper need over another? I start thinking about what size color gamut do I need? Okay, well, that means I might need to work in a particular color space. If I need that output resolution, what kind of resolution do I need on a scan? How good of optic do I need in order to keep the level of detail that I want in the final print? So by working backwards like that and thinking about the print first, I think it keeps you a little saner, because what you realize is that you don't need as much in terms of resolution, in terms of gamut volume, that you sort of go the other route, the way that most people do, that a lot of companies and photographers sort of advocate that you really need. Because if you sit down and you really look at the numbers of the final print, you know, in terms of resolution, in terms of gamut volume, of your ICC profiles, it's all much smaller and much sort of easier to get. And I think that we as photographers sometimes lose sight of that.
So let's stand back here and let's talk about your experience as a photographer. You went to RIT, you printed for literally thousands of hours in a traditional analog darkroom. You do a hybrid workflow now. Let's talk about, what do I really need? Let's just say that I'm Joe Photographer. I don't have a brand new beautiful Epson. Let's say I popped and I bought the brand new 3880. So I can do 13 by 19 that I think is a really good size print. What do I need resolution-wise, what you've seen, analog versus digital workflow versus whatever? I mean, what do I need? Do I need a 500 line per millimeter super nuclear radiation treated test lens to make this stuff on super panachromic nuclear fed fuel film? I mean, can I just shoot it on a Holga and say, hey, man, this is good enough? I mean, where do you draw the line?
Well, I think there's two areas. First off, in terms of film resolution, this is something that I think a lot of people don't think about. If your process is going to be one where you're going to be scanning, in my opinion, it's easier to scan a finer resolution film than it is a coarser film, just any day of the week. If you don't have a high-end scanner, it's easier to scan chromogenic material any day of the week than it is traditional black and white material. So sort of know what your limitations are and sort of work with them and make them part of the process instead of stuff you have to fight. In terms of sharpness, always, and everybody knows this, the better the lens, the better the image quality is going to be. If you're really looking for sharp, 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 if that's what you want, doesn't matter how good the scanner is, doesn't matter how good the printer is, it really boils down to how good is your capture lens. So the lens of the camera really does matter if you want sharp. If you want sort of a Holga look, if you want sort of that soft, creamy tonality, then that's fine as well. And then what you're looking for is a scanner that can capture all that beautiful, subtle gradation of tone. So it sort of depends what you're looking for, but I think that a lot of times people, once again, sort of overshoot the mark, and they sort of think they need to have everything at 110%. And some of the best work that I've ever made were just simple scans from Fuji Instax positives or Polaroid positives or stuff made of pinhole in a cardboard box. And it's not to say that you always need to go out and buy the latest and greatest thing. Sort of understanding what look you want, I think, is sort of key to begin with in thinking about film.
So let's interject into that. So here's the question. Of course, you want the best film you can get. I think the films that are made now by Fuji, Kodak, Ilford, whoever's making film, it's pretty good stuff, man. I mean, we're pretty lucky right now. I mean, we don't have all the things we used to have, but in reality, we're really lucky, I think, at this point.
Well, I think right now, there are people who will disagree with this comment, but I would think that right now, the film that's on the market is as good as it's ever been in terms of quality control, in terms of the resolution, in terms of the ability to really use a piece of film. It's really right now at the top of the bar.
Okay, so we got great film, and we love all that. This is good. Now, here's the question. Let's say I'm going to print, and this gets into another question about how big you should print. But nevertheless, let's just pick a normal size. Let's pick a 11 by 14 or an 8 by 10. I don't care. I mean, how much line per millimeter resolution do you think you need based off of current manufactured film stock that when you output this either optically? And here's another thing you brought up about lenses. Okay, so I have the brand new Leica unobtainable super killer 7009 per millimeter lens. So I got all this great resolution, but then I take my negative and I stick it in my enlarger with El Crapo enlarger lens.
all bets are off.
Well, I mean, that's the thing. So you've gone to this complete deal to capture this unbelievable resolution, and you're using ADOC CMS 20. I got this beautiful stuff. Then I scan it, and of course, if you scan it on an Aztec Premier that has an adjustable aperture, the best scan you're going to get, you'll have everything that's there plus more. And not everybody has that. People have, like, the new Epson V600 for $249, and they can make a pretty nice scan. I think the point is, I mean, you have an Imicon, this great high-end gear, and you guys are making this beautiful work, but let's push this into the realm of the normal photographer. Not super high-end Joe, just the guy that likes to take beautiful stuff, make some prints, and you can still put the stuff on the wall at a gallery. I guess the point is where do you draw the line on what you really need, the minimum? Well, I mean, what's going to get by to make something that's beautiful?
Right. The one thing I would say is that if you spend a whole bunch of money on a really good quality lens, the biggest mistake I see a lot of people do is they'll go out and buy a top-end Nikon or a top-end Canon or whatever, and then they'll stick a crap UV filter in front of it.
Right.
And it's like the light is going through all that glass. You're not helping yourself any here. I think sort of working with what you've got and the strengths that you have. I've seen scans that I've done, or I've seen digital files that were created with really not very sophisticated camera systems, not the greatest lenses, and I've seen them produce absolutely beautiful prints. It is interesting that you chose, when you were discussing your print size, like 8x10 or 11x14, and it's amazing to me how few years that have really gone by from when the darkroom was king, and most people made 8x10s and 11x14s. Nowadays, in sort of the digital environment, that's considered a very small print. Whereas nowadays, everybody's printing these massive-sized prints because they can. But in the analog days, no one ever did. And of course, to print bigger like that, all sorts of issues come into play. But to sort of address your question specifically, how much do you really need to make an 8x10 or an 11x14? To be honest, a decent scanner with a little bit of practice, and that's sort of the biggest thing here that I think a lot of people forget. You watch the commercials and everything seems easy. But the fact of the matter is there is a learning curve, and you are going to learn over the course of 6 months or a year how to make better scans than when you first opened the box. And people need to realize that just because you were told it's plug and play doesn't really mean it is. And learning sort of how to optimize that scanner, learning how to keep the film flatter, what's a good color space, all that's the kind of stuff that I think people need to realize that there is a sort of a learning process that they need to go through. With regards to resolution, I mean, to be honest, you always want to scan at what's going to be the best optical resolution. So if I was shooting 35mm, let's say, I personally don't believe that you need much more than, say, 75 to 100 megabytes from a 35mm negative as an RGB 16-bit file. Anything beyond that, and I don't really think you're extracting much that's going to be useful in terms of a print. And as a matter of fact, I would say that if you're not scanning on a high-end scanner, you'd be better to almost take that number and cut it in half. Because realistically speaking, even though that $200 or $500 scanner might say that it can hit 6,000 optical DPI, realistically speaking, it's really hitting a good 2020 or maybe even 3,000 if you're lucky. And you'd be better to sort of say, well, where am I really getting the sweet spot? So it's an easy test to run. Take your scanner, put a negative in it, and scan it at 10 different resolutions. And then take a look at it on your screen, and you'll see the one that looks the best. You'll see the one where you start having problems. And say, well, that now is going to be my scanner resolution. I think it's something that everybody sort of needs to tune in for their particular scanner, but I think that most people overscan because they feel they need more detail, because they've been told by the printing companies, well, look, our printer will print at 5,000 DPI or 2880. What they haven't been told is that very few papers can actually handle that resolution in a good way. To be honest, much resolution really beyond 1440 by 1440, it's hard to find a paper that can really use that much resolution well. What ends up happening is you have to end up on a higher-end system. You're dialing back your densities. You're dialing back your total ink in order to put more dots per square inch. So it's a trade-off. You're losing in one direction and gaining in another. And at 1440 by 1440, you can't see a dot anyways. So when you start thinking about it like that, most people in their digital file, let's say they were going to make an 8x10, you don't need much more than, say, 480 DPI. 360, 240 is sort of the standard, but I always tell people, if you can get 480, great. But I want that 480 to be as optical as possible. I want it to be something that you got out of the scan, not something that if your scan was 240 DPI, that you're going to res it up. Better to stick with the optical resolution in most cases.
Very interesting thought there. So, I mean, that goes to show you that I can really take a picture with a Kodak disposable camera, a Fuji disposable camera, I guess a Walgreen plain label disposable camera, drop it off at my local film center, have it developed and scanned and get an 8x10, and it's going to look pretty good.
Oh, it absolutely is. I mean, it's amazing. It's like people have sort of got this amnesia as to the fact that they sort of think that good images were never made before. People have been taking great photographs with not great cameras and not maybe the greatest technology for a real long time. And always having the latest, greatest thing in your hands is not necessarily the best thing, because it's a tool and you need to know how to use that tool. I mean, literally, you totally take that disposable negative from one of those instant cameras, scan it up on a decent scanner, a couple $100 scanner, and you'd be amazed at how absolutely beautiful the prints would look. As a matter of fact, it's kind of funny. When I did my second book, which was Through a Glass Darkly, it was all scans from Polaroid positives that were done on a Holga camera, the very first generation of the Holga Type 88 backs. I went to Staples and bought a $99 Epson scanner. I think it was a 3170, and it was on sale for $99. I did all the scans, and everything had to be 600 line screen because we were printing at the Salto Press in Belgium. And I spent a lot of time really refining the process, refining the scans, and getting them to where they were just absolutely amazing. Now, granted, it was easier to scan because they were positive. But when I sent the CDs off to the press, and this is arguably one of the finest printing presses in the world, when I spoke to the press people, they said these were some of the nicest scans they had ever seen. And I'm kind of chuckling because they were from a $99 Epson scanner that I bought on sale at Staples. And it was more about sort of understanding what the scanner could do. Could it scan a negative well? Maybe. But it could scan a positive really well. And understanding, I did the test. At what resolution was I getting the absolute best out of the scanner and when it would fall off? And I could determine that I could make about 7x7 and 10x10-inch prints with about as big as I could do with the resolution that I wanted. So I worked within the limitations of the materials, and that's how big my prints were. But by that token, the prints were perfect at that size because I was using these sort of low-tech materials and scanners to their furthest possible extent.
So let's talk about the infection of gear acquisition syndrome and how the photographic, I don't know if you want to call it the press, I don't know who fuels this, but people keep coming out with new gear. Especially in the digital realm. I haven't seen a new film camera in a while, and hopefully maybe we'll see one at some point. But nevertheless, there's new cameras coming out every day. The resolution keeps getting better. I mean, look at this new Leica M9. It's incredible for what it is. I mean, it's unbelievable to have a full-frame sensor digital camera with such a short film plane distance from the lens. I mean, they did a great job. Kodak made the sensor unbelievable. It's cool. But where do you draw the line?
I agree. It's gotten a little crazy. And this is one of the things that I've advocated now for years, is that if you look at the cost of a lot of these systems, does it really make sense? Are you really going to be able to get your value back out of that gear in sort of what its anticipated lifespan really is? I mean, that's the thing that's changed in our industry, is that cameras now have a built-in obsolescence. They never had that before. Remember when the M8 came out? Wasn't that many years ago? In 10 years, do you think anybody's going to be shooting an M8? Probably not. Are there any options of people being able to open the file formats for a lot of these systems 5-10 years down the road? So I think the manufacturers, when Leica was going to make the RBAC for the R system, I really was excited. Because I was, okay, here's somebody taking great camera body technology, and they're making a back that can go on, and the back can be upgraded. So I'm not having to dump everything. Now you notice that Leica never came out with it. I think what all these camera manufacturers have realized is that it's in their best interest to build an obsolescence and every 2 to 3 years maximum come out with a new flagship model. And then, of course, through good advertising, good reviews, the sort of need by photographers to feel that they're doing stuff that's on that leading edge, people will purge their gear and go out and buy this latest, greatest technology. But I don't think it's smart. I think it's a poor use of money, and it's a poor use of resources in our industry. I mean, if you can go out right now and buy yourself a used Hasselblad on eBay for nothing, buy yourself a 500cm, a good 80 lens, and you can get yourself a decent scanner for under $500, $600. You're going to have to spend an awful lot of money on digital camera systems to equal the quality of a really good scan for one of those negatives. An awful lot of money. And given the lifespan of these systems, you're not going to get your money back. If you're a commercial photographer who needs 24-hour turnaround, I guess that makes sense. But for the average person, it's just not a wise investment, in my opinion. And it's not to say that, believe me, I don't have Leica M9 envy or anything like that, but it's just to say that I look at it and I'm going, I just can't wrap my mind. I've got a beautiful M7 that I love. The scans look fantastic. And I'll put a good scan from an M7 meg against anything the M9 is going to do. That's not to say the M9 is not going to be a great camera, but to say that it somehow trumps all the film M's doesn't make sense. And I think that people forget that. They think, oh, it's the M9, it's the latest, greatest, it must be the best. No, not the best. It's just different. It's a different type of system, different way of working. And I think for most people, it doesn't make sense. So for most photographers, I don't think the new digital M9 would make sense. Now, if I was a high-end professional journalist or something, maybe. But even then, you might as well go shoot video and just get it over with.
Well, I did an interview the other day with a gentleman named Alan Chen. Very prolific, well-known photojournalist. He's up there with Nakwe and those guys, okay? And he's shooting all the world. And we did the interview from Beijing. And guess what he's shooting on?
What's he shooting?
Film. He's souping in the hotel room, and he's still scanning. I mean, he'll shoot a story for the Wall Street Journal or the New York Times or some magazine, and he'll actually shoot on film, soup it in the bathroom in the hotel, scan it, and upload his pictures. Now, that doesn't mean he doesn't have digital gear with him, too. But, I mean, he's doing his workflow that way.
But it makes more sense. You have more options. And I encourage everybody that I speak to, I say, you should absolutely be looking at the digital cameras. And if it makes sense for your budget and your workflow to have both, that to me is sort of a smarter way of working. Sort of putting all your eggs in one basket doesn't necessarily make sense. So I encourage people, have a film camera, have your digital camera, and pull out what's appropriate for the look that you want in the final print. Because you can scan a piece of film in a very different way than maybe you're stuck to what that sensor and the camera is going to give you. You've got a lot of options the way different films are going to respond when they are scanned. And so in a lot of environments, you might not have the ability to charge your batteries and all sorts of issues in terms of durability. So I like to have both. I don't like ever having to make too much of a choice if one is really better. I always just say that they're different, and it's important to sort of use differences to our advantages. And people who are shooting the digital stuff, this is something that I think is coming down the pipe here pretty quickly. Look at all these digital cameras that are coming out. And I know the Leica didn't put in the M9, but look at all these cameras. What's the one feature you see all these digital SLRs having now? High-definition video. High-definition video is taking over the still quality and the still features of so many of these digital SLR cameras. In such that I think in a very short period of time, in a matter of under 5 years, you're going to have a lot of people going out shooting their high definition 4,000 pixel width video and then just editing down frames. And I think that's something that we as an industry need to be really aware of, because our industry is going to morph over the next 5 or 10 years. People talk about this digital revolution of what's happened the last 10 years, and I'm like, this has been nothing. You wait to the next 5 or 10 years, I said, I think there's going to be a massive fracture in our industry. And I think so much of it happened 10 years ago, and I think we're just now starting to really see the effects of it. And video, it's going to be incredible what it does, unfortunately, to our industry. I think your friend who is a journalist, I talk to a lot of journalists, it's not that hard to pull out a video and shoot a series and edit down the frame. If the publication's only going to be in a magazine or online, you have more than enough resolution from that video grab. Uncommon from what like National Geographic did when they were shooting a 16mm movie. Pull out a frame and print it in the magazine. We're going that way in video right now with a lot of this journalism, and it scares me a little bit because I see our industry in some areas sort of breaking apart. That's one of the reasons why I want to hold on to film so much. I think there's so much there, and there's so much there to offer. It just makes sense, if it, once again, to have both and not really have to give one up for the other.
What do you think here about print sizing? Let's talk about print sizing. So we've chatted here about what you really need, and I think people get all tied up needing to buy the best gear and all this stuff. So let's talk about print size. I mean, we've been talking about what you need, and I guess just sort of a rant about gear acquisition syndrome and how people need to, I guess, concentrate more on shooting photos and worrying about the latest and greatest. But let's talk about print size for a moment. You print big. You have Roland DaVinci system that'll do 60 inches wide. You have a new Epson 9900. That's beautiful. What about the guy that's at home with a 2880 and he wants to print an 8x10? Does it make his photography any worse? Do you need to print that big? What do you really think the optimal print size is? There was an article that somebody put up on APUG about the size of the photograph and how that relates to how you look at it, the intimacy of the photograph. What's your thoughts on sizing?
Well, we ran a gallery here at Indian Hill for 7 years. We represented artists from all over the United States. And we still have a gallery space, but it simply represents my work. So I'm going to talk, I guess, to this specific question from sort of the gallery standpoint. So it becomes a size when a gallery brings a piece of work in, that it becomes harder to sell. And the easy way to see this is walk around your house with a tape measure and look at the walls that you live with and say, how many walls do I have that can handle a 4x6 foot print? And you're probably going to say maybe one or two. Most walls handle a 16x20, maybe a 20x30, but that's about it. If you go to Europe or Asia, it's definitely on the smaller size and even smaller than that. So if you're a photographer and you're really wanting to sell work, then small to medium is really better than big. And that's the one thing. A lot of people buy these big printers because they can print big. And there is something nice about having that option. But another nice part about the big printers is that you can put more than one image across the run at a time and be more efficient in terms of printing. And that's sort of been, in a lot of cases, my take when I print for clients, is that it just makes me more efficient in terms of doing their work for them. But I don't think that most photographers really need to print much bigger than 1620, 2024 at the outside. It also gets much more difficult to transport work that size. It's much more expensive to finish a print that size. There is always that sort of urge that if it was just a little bit bigger, I'd sell it better. Not necessarily. I mean, my experience of running the gallery was that most people came in, and if it was 16 by 20, 20 by 24, the client could visualize in their home or in their office where it could fit. But when they're looking at buying one of my Sakura prints that were 3 by 9 feet, they had to take the measurements and go home and think about it. And they had to go home and see if it'll fit. And any gallery director will tell you, the moment the client leaves your space and they haven't given you a credit card, there's a really good chance you'll never see them again. Not always feel, well, just give me a little payment and I'll hold it for you. It also goes on the other end. If it's a really, really, really small print, even though it might be a gorgeous 4x5 or 5x7 contact platinum print, let's say it's $1,000, people also do look at the smaller size and they kind of shake their head as well. So they think maybe it's overpriced for the size that it is. And a lot of people aren't sort of educated as to the different processes and the cost and the time involved in making them. So personally, if it was me and when I'm working with artists that I know or people that I work with, I tell them you really should be shooting for stuff that's really not much bigger than, say, 24 by 30 or something like that. Because anything bigger than that, you'll literally see your client base fall in half. It literally falls in half. Because people get intimidated by the size. Even though they might be impressed by it, they might walk up to them and go, ooh and ah. They can't visualize where it would be in their life because it's bigger than they're sort of used to thinking about on a wall. So I tell everybody, walk around. I mean, you'll see me in restaurants. I'll be looking at walls and how big stuff is. And I go to people's homes and I start sizing it up and saying, well, what size prints would fit in here? And after doing that for many, many, many years, that's sort of where I came to sort of the size that I try to put a lot of my own works into. That's not to say that something couldn't be 3x7 feet if I feel it needs to be from an artistic standpoint. But I always sort of keep in the back of my mind, hey, you know, I'm a businessman too, and I want to eat, and I want to have health insurance and all that kind of stuff. And if I actually want to be selling work, being conscious of the size that somebody can actually live with in their own home or their own office is important.
What do you think about small prints? Do you think a small print draws you in more? What's your thoughts on how the viewer is pulled into your photography, into your photograph? If it's small, they have to get up closer, they have to get into it more.
When I was in college a long time ago, I belonged to the Itty Bitty Print Club. It's a group of people that we were dedicated to the idea of tiny, tiny, tiny prints. I mean, I did 4x5 contact printing for years. Of course, I would always hear from family members that they couldn't see the prints, they were too small. So I think the small prints, there is sort of that jewel factor, that it's a precious gem and that you want to get up and see it. But you have to be careful because I think that at a certain point, people are going to say that they can't see it or they're going to say that it's too much money for what the size that the print is if you're trying to sell it like in a gallery space. Unless a person's famous or something, and then all this is not really necessarily on the table. But I would say 5'7", 8'10", it's a nice jewel size. One thing that I do encourage people to do is not print something like 8.5 by 11, only because it's the size of a magazine page. It's the size of a piece of paper. And I say try to print at a scale that's not familiar to people. Because if somebody's looking at a piece of paper and it looks like the piece of paper they've been reading all day at work, there's too much of a connection to what the scale is. You're better to print it at a slightly larger size, 14, 17, or print it slightly smaller so it's not a familiar size to them. It makes it seem fresh. And it's just a small shift in size. Like 13, 19 is interesting because it's not a size that people normally encounter.
Well, exactly. It's different, and it's good to be different.
It is, especially nowadays. I mean, everybody's running, for the most part, similar machines, similar papers, similar sizes. And I say you can always print stuff different sizes on those sheets, sort of working in a size that isn't familiar, I think, is important in terms of making your work sort of feel fresh.
Another thing I think we should chat about, you did a audio blog the other day about edition size. I really love the thought of one. You shoot one, here it is. I don't know if that's because lately I'm on this instant film kick and I'm eating up Fuji Pak film like it's water. I love the thing of one. I don't know why.
It's the kind of thing that I think for any photographer to make the decision that they're only going to make one print. At first, it's the most terrifying decision they probably think they'll ever have to make. Because it is that sort of security blanket of knowing that you can always make more copies of something. But at the same time, I think that security blanket in many cases becomes a jail cell. And photographers never break out and they never start making new work because they can live off the 5 images they've ever made. They're never pushing themselves, never reinventing themselves. And with the current pace of technology, you might make your print today on your printer, but in 10 years, if you had to go back and reprint that image, there's no saying you'd be able to, that you'd be able to get the same kind of printers and the same kind of papers. And so personally, I've always sort of had the personal drive that the next image I make will always be the best image. And I sort of have that sort of optimistic attitude. So I go out, I make the work, I make that one print. And when I work in Photoshop, sort of my whole sort of philosophy is very minimal. I don't do multiple versions, and I never go back to an image. I start, I finish, I'm done. I like to think of it like a jazz musician doing an improv. You can never do it the same way twice. You go in, you make it, and you just be done. Make the image and finish it. And then I move on, and then I make the print, and I'm done with it. And I can look at the print, I can love the print, I can sell it for a slightly higher price point because it is only a one of one. And it changes your client's relationship to your work. And this is something that's very interesting also from a gallery standpoint. When we would have work on the wall and say, and all the artists that we carried, we required that they do limited editions or we wouldn't even bring them in because we knew from our own personal experiences that that would be something that would help us and help them. And so most of the artists did editions of like 10 and 15, and some did smaller. But if you got a print on a wall and it's number one of 10, and let's just say, for instance, it's selling for $500, if a client comes in and they see it's number one of 10, they know there's 10 more prints. So there's no incentive for them to have to buy that today. But the moment you say, this is the only one, this is number one of one, they have to think about the artwork now as a painting. Their relationship to the way they think about your work has changed. And now it's sort of the Moscow rules of shopping. Buy it today because it might not be here tomorrow. And we found that to be incredible. But not only incredible in terms of sales, but also incredible in terms of me as a working artist. Because they produce so much more work. I'm not going back and reprinting work again and again and again. I'm always sort of looking at that next thing that I want to do and that next project that I want to try. Not to say that I don't like the work that I've already done, but I build from the work. I use the work that I've done as a foundation for new work. And I think that's just, for me, it's a very fresh way of working.
No, I think so, and I'm almost thinking that if you're shooting on film instead of instant stock, what are your thoughts about putting the negative in the mat and then backlighting it? So here's the neg and the print, and you really got the only one.
I've had a lot of people who've suggested that, people who I know who have actually done that. My relationship to my film has changed over the last 25 years, and the way that I think about my negative, I mean, nowadays, if you're making a one-of-one, and because you're scanning film, you're no longer needing the negative once you've scanned it. I mean, it's not like the darkroom where every time you wanted to make a new print, you had to have that negative. So my relationship to my film has changed tremendously. And I consider, I know there's going to be gas and out there in the industry of people freaking when I say this, but I look at the negative as a disposable part of my process. It's really not something that I guard as precious and sacred the way I used to when I worked in the darkroom. Now, once I scan the film, my film is now a digital file. And once I make the prints, I really don't care because I'm about making prints. And once the print's on the wall, that's all I care about. Everything else is just part of the process. And I think we as photographers have gotten hung up on that. A painter makes a piece of work, and it's on the wall, and that's it. I think you grow as an artist very quickly when you sort of let go of these things that sort of hold you back. And I think that, for me at least, a lot of it was sort of going back and revisiting my negatives, and I started realizing that that wasn't helping me as a photographer, and sort of just rethinking my relationship with my film and then going to one of ones has been the best decisions that I've ever made.
No, I think it's great. I mean, think about this, okay? So there's certain images, Stephen, during a photographer's career that you might be lucky enough to hit on the one or two that you could sell multiples of. It could be a great picture of a movie star, or you had the Marilyn Monroe-style picture with the wind blowing. Whatever. I mean, there's certain things that are just going to be like, whoa. But I mean, really, if you think about it, how many photographs that you shoot, and let's just use yourself as an example. So Stephen's out shooting. How many of these things, if you sold one and it sold right away, that you couldn't go back and make another one similar, but it's not the same one? I mean, where do you call the point towards, well, I can replicate that. It's not a big deal.
Right. And painters do it all the time. They'll work in a style. They'll work in a particular subject and work it again and again. I like to think I go out, I make that particular artwork, and I'm going to move on sort of after having done that. Personally, I'm never comfortable sort of sitting still, sort of doing the same thing again and again and again. I like to constantly be reinventing myself and reinventing the way that I see myself as a photographer.
No, I think that's good, and I think, like you said, it will actually kick you into gear to make new work.
Well, you have to, because if you've got galleries selling your work and you've got 10 prints on the wall, you don't have an awful lot of time to sit around and not make new work. Because when those 10 prints are gone, they're gone. But some of this also got back to you. But sort of going through all this in my mind years ago, I also thought about photography really started out as a one-of-one. I mean, you think about the daguerreotypes, it was a one-of-one process. And yes, you do have the ability of doing unlimited outputs nowadays. But it doesn't really help you, in my opinion. In my opinion, they actually, I think, hurt photographers when they just say, oh, I'm just going to print unlimited copies and whatever. I think it's better to sort of look at that image, pour all your energy, make the one perfect print, learn all you can from what you've just done, and then go out and make another print. It's just a little bit of a cleaner way of working.
I think you're right there. And I don't know why people are in this whole loop of, well, I can shoot this and we'll make a limited edition of 250. Well, you're dreaming. Make a book.
Yeah, you got books, you got posters, you got note cards. Make the artwork something that's precious. Make the artwork is something that's special. If you're treating your artwork and your printer that you're making the stuff on like your Heidelberg press, that doesn't make any sense. I'd say, you know, go out and make it one print, sell it for what you really need to make as a working artist to survive. And then if you want to make 20 more copies, fine. Have a limited edition. Do a poster. Do a book. Do a blur book. Do whatever you want. But think of the artwork as a one of one. And I think it's just a better way of working. There's so many wonderful ways to reproduce your photographs nowadays beyond sort of the inkjet print or the darkroom print. And take advantage of those other ways. This is interesting. About 97 or 98, I was doing some work up at the Steinauer Press. My friend Steven, who ran the press, said to me at the time, he says, most people will never know you from your actual artworks. Even if you did 50 copies, most people are going to know you from your books. They're going to know you from posters and stuff like that. And I started thinking about that, and I said, you know, he's right. I could make one copy and then do a ton of posters. Why not? And sort of make that one print and really get what I need out of it from a financial standpoint and from a learning standpoint as an artist. And then let the other reproduction be what feeds the need of people who want a copy that didn't get the actual print. I think it just makes more sense.
It does, because photographs are supposed to be a piece of art. And like you said, how do you compete with other pieces of art? If you want to do a painting, do you make 10 of them? Do you sculpt 10 pieces of something? Do you make things in multiples? Even if you make decoupage art, you're not going to do 10 of the same thing.
I agree. There are painters nowadays who are doing reproductions of their paintings. There are people who make resin cast mold of the surface so they look like the actual paintings. And that kind of horrifies me, because one of the things that I like about painting is that there it is and you're done. And there's something wonderful about that. There's something wonderful about the fact that it's complete. Or when you make a sculpture out of marble, there is the sculpture and it's done. And I think that photography can really take a lesson from that and just be like, look, make that one perfect print. Put everything into it and move on. And if you need to make more copies, if all of a sudden this becomes your most popular image ever, fine, then do some posters. Do something else. Find another way to reproduce it. But I think that thinking about your work as a one of one, I don't know, personally I find it very motivating. And at the same time, I find it very refreshing that I'm not having to go back, dig up a negative from 10 years ago, try to find the papers and everything that I used to use, and somehow make this work. I want to make the next work. I just think that's a better way of working.
I definitely think so, and I think that it's refreshing. It's something new, and most people don't think about it, and you never hardly see things that are in one editions, but I think it's great.
Whenever I talk to other photographers and I tell them about this, at first they get this horrified look on their face, and they're looking at me like I'm crazy. But once they think about it, I can't tell you how many of them say, you know what, that's really not a bad idea. Because they start to realize that with the fleeting nature of technology and all the things we've discussed, that in an awful lot of ways, doing a one-of-one really does make a lot of sense.
So what do you think is going to keep people shooting film? I mean, we talked about the chase and the race for digital and buying this new stuff. Do you think that digital now, because of the technology, is finally starting to catch up with itself, that people might look at going backwards? And I know a lot of people in a lot of different genres, especially wedding photography, have been regressing. And I wouldn't say it's a regress. They're going back to original photography because of the look and the ease of workflow. What do you think is going to keep analog photography alive? I've chatted about this and ranted actually a few times on APUG about if you don't embrace hybrid, it's all going to die.
Right. Well, I do think that at this point, the hybrid is what's going to keep the film alive. I mean, the margin on making darkroom paper is nothing. So I'm sort of looking at this saying, well, scanning film makes an awful lot of sense. Digital printing really is phenomenal. I mean, believe me, if I thought I could make a better print in the darkroom, I would. But at this point, what you can print digitally with regards to what you can print on I mean, I support over 300 papers. It's amazing what you can print on if you really sort of put your mind to it. What I think is going to keep film alive is actually a couple of things. First off, as horrific as recession has been, it's actually been a great thing for keeping film alive because the pace of digital technology in terms of the constant upgrades, the constant thing, everything new, has sort of stopped. And not to say that there's not new stuff out, there's obviously new cameras and all that, but it's not as crazy as it was a couple of years ago. And I think because, you know, people just aren't going to be spending as much money as they were on these constant upgrades. And I think a lot of people also are sitting back when they went into digital thinking that it was going to give them everything they've ever dreamed of. And they're looking at the quality of the prints, they're looking at what it costs to make everything. And I think there's a lot of people that are sort of waking up to the fact that it isn't the holy grail. It offers an awful lot to you, but at the same time, it takes a lot from you in terms of your finances and in terms of your actual time. So I think that that also is, there's the marketplace seems to be becoming more educated to the real cost in terms of time that it takes to work digitally. It's not as fast as has been sort of told to everybody. And I also think that one of the bigger saving graces for analog technology are younger photographers. On the Digital Revolution a few weeks ago, I told a story that I was out with my little Fuji Instax 55i, and I was at a local farmer's market here in Vermont taking pictures of my daughter and some of her friends. And when the first instant piece of film came off the side of the camera, you've never seen little kids' eyes get so big. And what I realized is these kids are all young enough that they've never seen instant material. And for them, this was like the coolest thing they'd ever seen. They were like, oh my God, I could have had a Leica M9 and they wouldn't have cared. That the little instant prints coming out and they're watching it develop before their eyes was just amazing. And I think that there's a lot of younger photographers who are getting in and who can buy a Lomo or a point-and-shoot or whatever, and they can get film. And it's a more inexpensive way for them to get in photography compared to, say, the high-end digital. And it's fun, and it's different from what everybody else is doing. And I think that's important because I think sort of the fact that it has a different look. These kids were all raised on digital. I mean, there are a whole group of younger photographers coming out right now who, for them, film is not something they were ever raised on. And so it's kind of like, I just had a birthday recently. I bought a record player. I bought a 1960s retro wood record player. And there's something about the sound. There's something about the sound of vinyl that I love. And I think the same thing is true about film. And I think people are starting to appreciate that there's a look to a scan from a good piece of film that is fairly difficult, if not impossible, to really replicate digitally. I mean, you can get the look with some of these different software programs and stuff, but it's different. It's a different workflow. It's a different way of working. And I think that's important. So I do think that the hybrid workflow, as I've been sort of advocating it in terms of shooting film, scanning, and printing digitally, make a lot of sense. The one thing that I am excited about and that I'm hoping actually to explore this winter when it's gusting here in Vermont and I don't want to go outside is the idea of digital negatives. Making a lot of digital negatives for the purposes of platinum and stuff like that. I think that's an exciting area that I know a lot of people have been doing a lot of work with. But I think that the technology now is really getting good enough that that's also viable. I think that that's something that is also interesting. So I think that a lot of these old processes and the fact that they're different from what everybody else is doing, that's what's going to keep analog alive. But the one thing that I do want to say, though, is that there are a lot of young photographers out there who are interested in doing this kind of stuff. And a lot of them contact me through the Digital Revolution. They're trying to find information. And there's such a wealth of information out there in communities like APUG and online. And I just want to encourage everybody to share everything they can, because this is also the way we keep analog alive, is by sharing this information with the younger photographers. Because the more of us shooting film, the better it is.
This is so true. And I think that, like you said, the newer people getting into photography have never shot film. And I think they've grown up digital. Digital cable, digital phones, digital cameras. That's how it is. And when they see an analog product, they're like, the magic is there again. It's something fresh. It's new. It's not the same as their friends at school, the same as their family members. It's different.
It is different. And I mean, look at something like Lomo. I mean, they've made these inexpensive plastic cameras really hip and amazing. And we've all got our issues, some of the sales pitches and stuff like that. But at the end of the day, they're promoting film. They're promoting film photography and getting a whole generation of young photographers interested in taking pictures with film and with instant materials. And I can only applaud that. I mean, that to me is just good, because I look at those people, they might start out with one of the new Dianas that shoots 35mm, and they get into that, and who knows, maybe in a couple of years they'll be doing something else, and moving more and more into film and mixing it up with this ease that they have with digital technology, and they're becoming hybrid photographers. And I think that's great.
And one last thing I wanted to chat about that you had brought up before I had a chance to get to it. was your use of the Instex Mini camera, and even more so, I want to talk about the Instex Mini back that goes on the Diana. What's your thoughts on that? I mean, I love instant photography, and now this gives you a different outlet than the cameras that are fine, that are manufactured by Fuji, but gives you a little bit more creative control.
I agree. The 55i is a neat camera. I bought it. I like it. I shot a fair amount with it, but I also had some Diana sitting around. So I purchased the Diana back, and I tried it, and I thought it was really great. The one thing I did find, though, was that the new Dianas, the instant back with the little adapter, and it actually produces fairly sharp instant material. And all my recent works from, the last 15 years really aren't that sharp. They're actually fairly soft tonal reproductions. So what I did is I have a whole bunch of 1960s vintage Diana cameras. And anybody listening to this, the two do go together. You can absolutely take a brand new Instax Lomo Diana back and stick it on a vintage Diana camera. It's not the easiest thing. You may have to do a little cutting with a knife. You've got to do a little bit of taping with gaffer's tape. But the visual quality that you get, unbelievable. Absolutely unbelievable. It's like a small sweet spot of focus, and then just the most gorgeous, subtle, out-of-focus renderings going all the way to the edge. It is just breathtaking. And it was a look that I couldn't get with the new system, and that I couldn't get with the 55i. So a little trick that I found on the 55i is it comes with that little close-up filter. If you put the close-up filter on the camera and put the camera on infinity, everything from 3 feet to 10 feet is fairly sharp, and everything else has this beautiful out-of-focus rendering. So it's a sort of way of causing the camera to work against itself, but it produces this really nice instant material. Whereas with the Diana back, I thought it was great on the new cameras. I happen to like the 75mm and the 110 the best on the new cameras, because it still retained that sort of softer Diana quality, but when you put the 38 and the 55 on there, to me it was just too sharp. And that's what sort of drove me to breaking out one of the old Diana cameras and seeing if I could sort of retrofit it to fit the back. And it's fantastic. I now have four of them done and sort of bounce back and forth. Because each one, of course, like every Diana camera, is a little bit different.
Very interesting. I think that is quite cool. And I'm going to have to try that close-up filter. I have one of the new 210s.
Yep. Put the filter on and set the camera. Set it for close-up mode. Leave it on infinity. And what ends up happening is it looks more like a Holga, sort of Polaroid. It's got this wonderful roundness, but everything in the foreground is still somewhat sharp. I think between you and me, we're going through a tremendous amount of Instax material. Because yeah. I must have gone through 10 boxes of the minis. I mean, I was buying the mini stuff there for a few weeks. I probably went through 600 or 700 sheets of the mini material in the course of a month. Well, because in order to do these kind of tests, when I was testing the camera, I would try every possible variable way of doing it. And then I'd determine what worked and what didn't. And then I would retrofit it and try something else. And the same thing happened when I was trying the instant back on the new Diana. I tried all different ways of mounting it to see what I could do and what I couldn't do. And then when I put the new instant back on the old Diana, it took a fair amount of material to figure out what the frame lines were going to be, what was going to be possible in terms of a lens to subject distance is maybe 3 feet as opposed to 10 feet as opposed to 15 feet, and learning what the camera could do at all of those different settings. And then sort of writing all this down and saying, okay, if I'm going to work in this style, here's sort of the parameters that work based upon my testing. Here's the stuff that doesn't really work. So I'm not going out and shooting 10 sheets of film that I know the object's too far away that I'm interested in and it won't reproduce. So I do a lot of testing before I go out and actually shoot. So if Fuji's stock went up a little bit, it was because of me.
Well, I mean, that's good, though.
When I shoot film, I do the same thing. I mean, I've been recently obsessed with the Fuji Across. And Dan development, X-Tall, straight road and all, and sort of what would give me the best out of that particular film. And I've gone through more rolls and done more clip tests and more checks than I want to think about. And I'm just now getting to the point that I feel I've sort of nailed down the process that I like.
This is very cool. So, Stephen, let's talk about the other things you're up to. You have some beautiful camera bags you're manufacturing. You have a couple other products that I think people should really look at. And then, of course, they can go look at your fine photography. So let's talk about where they can hear about the digital revolution, how they can embrace digital technology but still be an analog photographer. Tell me about this stuff.
Sure. Just digitalrevolution.com, like film, digital, digital. I write articles, do videos, audios, 2 to 3 times a week usually. It covers really a broad range of anything from analog to digital, hybrid. Anything is on the table. If anybody wants to talk about something, I'm willing to discuss anything that has to do with photography. There's also a Flickr site. There's a Digital Revolution group on Flickr that people can join, and they can start the conversations that they want to start. and get other people who lead the site sort of involved. And once again, I think conversation is really key. I think photographers need to speak to each other more about these sort of issues, and I'm sort of hoping to bring that together. The Digital Revolution is a site that I totally underwrite. I don't do advertising into sponsors or anything. And so I make different products to help support the site. My newest one that just came out is the Bare Bones Bag Stealth. It's the Bare Bones Bag that I've been selling now for a year, and there's a lot of discussions on it on the Rangefinder forum. It's an unpadded, virtually indestructible camera bag. The new one is all black. It's jet black, has no Velcro. I came up with a way of securing the closure that is secure and solid, yet you have none of that Velcro noise, there's no magnets, there's no clips. So for a street photographer, it's a nice discreet way to carry a rangefinder system or a small system. I also have been working with Matt Abelson of Abelson Scope Works, and we've developed a new pinhole camera. I have the first one here in about 2 to 3 weeks, and it's called the Cuboid. It's a 3x3-inch square made out of a solid block of aluminum is bored out, and it uses cassettes to go in just like a Hasselblad back. It shoots 120. It has a 25mm pinhole that actually can be taken out, and you can put different kinds of pinholes in. You can put zone plates in, whatever you want. It's completely recessed on the outside, so there's really no parts to stick up. It's got built-in levels. My idea was I wanted to create a pinhole camera that was truly a professional grade, something that you could throw in a bag year after year after year and would just last. So once again, we milled it out of a solid piece of aluminum, and one that would give me as a working photographer a lot of options. So what we built into the Cuboid was a few things. First off, it can do individual frames. It shoots a 6-6 frame, but not necessarily. It has interchangeable masks that were acid etched that can be magnetically put to the inside of the camera. So it actually can make an image that's 6 high by a little wider and the edges fade off on the side, or you can do 6-4-5. You can sort of pop these masks in and out when you put the film in to sort of change what the shape of the negative is physically going to be. But additionally, you have the ability of doing the overlapping frames. And I posted a lot of articles on Digital Revolution about the idea of panoramic overlapping frame techniques, whether it was the Leica or a point-and-shoot camera, where you do panoramic images. Think of it kind of like a motion picture where you cut frames out. And you get sort of this overlapping of frames that produce a panoramic image. The camera is designed to allow that as well. So it's sort of this creative powerhouse in terms of single images, different format masks, overlapping frames, made here in the United States. There's only 12 of them are being produced. There'll be 6 available initially, but just 12 are actually on the docket right now to be made.
No, I think that's great that you guys are cranking out new product.
I'll have it at Photo Expo in New York.
There we
go. I'm going to bring it with me and sort of have it there, and maybe I'll take a few pinholes on the floor.
Well, I mean, how often do you see new analog capture devices being manufactured?
It's true, and especially ones that are made in the States. You just don't. I ran into Matt years ago. I own a couple of his different cameras that I've purchased, and the Hexomniscope, and we made the Pinzoni system that we're still working on, which is the multifocal length pinhole zone plate system for the Leica, and sort of approached him with this idea of doing this, and it's something that he was really interested in. He'd always kind of thought about this. And we looked at all the different pinhole designs that were out there, and a lot of them had shutters that were on the outside of the camera, which meant you could brush your hand up against an accidentally exposed film. This has got a shutter inside of the camera, so there's nothing on the outside of the camera. It's basically the size of a peach in your hand. Sort of thinking as a pro photographer, what would I really want in a pinhole camera that I could take anywhere? Now, I'm excited. I've been thinking about the last 3 months to make the thing so far, so we're getting close to being done.
Now, that is great stuff, and Stephen, I really appreciate you joining us today, chatting on some things that have been going on with yourself in the Digital Revolution and analog photography, and we definitely look forward to having you back again, chatting about all kinds of fun stuff.
Sounds great.
Well, there you go. Stephen Schaub, the leader of the Digital Revolution and an all-around cool guy. He's got some great stuff, beautiful artwork, beautiful hybrid printing, just an all-around great guy. Definitely check out his website, his podcast, just a lot of neat stuff going on with Stephen. The Inside Analog Photography radio program has been brought to you by Fujifilm, making life more colorful over at www.fujifilmusa.com. Our friends at Richard Photo Lab at richardphotolab.com. DR5 over at www.dr5.com. Iger Studios over at igerstudios.com. Upstrap at upstrap-pro.com. And of course, our media partners, APUG, the Analog Photography User Group, over at www.apug.org. Our photography philanthropy partners, George Eastman House International Museum of Photography and Film over at www.geh.org. I've been your host, Scott Shepard, here on Inside Analog Photography Radio. We'll be back next week with more great analog photography.